Camp Leichhardt by Greg Barron. Read by Matthew R. Grigo.
Setting off early, I told Chuck I was heading offshore to fish the islands. This was just a bullshit story in case someone asked. Instead, I chucked lures up one of the creeks for most of the morning, a shallow, fast-running mangrove-lying gutter that just about everything avoided. 2 or 3 kilometres up, however, I found it quite fishable, particularly in and around another side creek, guarded by a big salty on a sandbar. Despite appearances, I managed only one small mangrove jack, 2 fork-tailed catfish, and an impressive surfer strike that went no further than a nice visual experience. By late morning, I pulled up to the bank and at a respectful distance from the water had a snooze in the shade, hat low over my face, mindful of the possibility of not getting much sleep in the coming night. By mid-afternoon, I was back on the water, working my way snag by snag downstream towards the main river channel. As the sun set, I tethered the boat to an overhanging branch with a clear view of the river. Malia hadn't known exactly when and what to expect that evening, so I settled down to wait, nibbled a sandwich and drank flavourless long-life orange juice. The river just before and after dusk is never motionless. Things slithered around out in the mangroves, predatory fish chopped a baitfish on the surface. They were easily identifiable by the boofing of their big mouths as they fed, like a bucket scooped through the surface of the water. The insects kept up a constant cacophony, and somewhere in the distance I heard flying foxes on the move. Even at this distance I could smell them. I noticed some people found it unpleasant, and others, like me, regarded it as just as part of the smell of the bush. The mozzies were bad here, and the only thing that kept them at bay was a thick layer of insect repellent. As daylight disappeared, the only sign that there were other members of my species on the planet was the moving pinprick light of a satellite high up in the sky, tracking through Orion's belt. Otherwise, the world was its own. Nature ruled here. Another hour passed before I heard anything out of the ordinary. The distant high note of an engine coming from upstream. Few people were desperate enough to fish this river at night, so I had a pretty fair idea that this must be them. Besides, I'd heard the old murk on 3 or 4 occasions now, and was familiar with the sound. Starting the engine, I let it warm up, creeping along the hull to untie the line I'd fastened to a branch. If I hadn't been watching so intently, they might have gone past without me seeing them. The only light on the punt was a soft glow at the console from the chart plotter and sounder, the men on board just barely illuminated. I took no risks, letting them pass by the creek entrance before I twisted the throttle and pulled up from behind my curtain of vegetation, gunning the motor, securing the knowledge that they'd never hit a Honda over their own screaming outboard. I waited at the entrance of the creek until they rounded the next bend. Then, driving out to the channel, I gave chase. Something told me that one way or another tonight, I'd find the threads of connections that link the players in this strange and complex situation. Confident that my own electronics were screened from view by the console, I took it easy, using one of several previously established chart plotter routes to navigate the river safely. The tide was rising, the peak an hour away, so there was plenty of water over the sandbars and snags. The boat I was following moved at a good clip, better than 15 knots, about as fast as was advisable at night, particularly taking into account that we had 5 knots of tidal current against us. Tidal flow, however, is not evenly distributed across a riverbed, back at ease, races and sluggish pools. Part of the trick is not to buck the fastest flow, but to find the path of least resistance. I'm not sure what warned me, maybe butterflies in my belly, the feeling that things had been just a tad too easy. Passing by a peninsula called Mutton Point, I cut the motor, pulling in close to the bank, still moving along, but very slowly and almost inaudibly, scanning the long, straight stretch ahead. Not only could I no longer see them, I couldn't hear the screaming murk either. I was beginning to think they'd simply passed on by, that I was wasting time, when I heard a soft voice out of the water. I turned, seeing the shape of the boat and the men inside it not 50 metres away. Even the dull glow of the plotter screen was gone. They'd obviously shut it off in their efforts to check for anyone who might be following. Namely, me. Minutes ticked down. 5, 10, They were being careful. But I can be patient when I need to be. Eventually, as if they were satisfied, a match flared and someone lit a ciggy. What must have been a stubby bottle whistled out through the air, landing with a splashy glass and a white puddle of phosphorescence. Then the sound of a starter rope. 5, 6 times. A cough. A splutter. Finally, the motor caught, rev madly before settling into a gurgling, erratic rhythm. A click of the gear engaging and away it went, straining until the hull planed, then roared off down the river. With a push on the gear lever and a twist of the throttle handle, I was away after them. I wasn't in the slightest bit surprised when the other boat slowed and began to move into the channel that led to the secret lagoon I'd fished with Malia. They'd obviously charted the route well, for the vessel scarcely slowed as it tackled the shallows, surprising a massive school of mullet that erupted on the surface over perhaps half an acre of river surface, only to be disturbed again by me. One or two smacked into the aluminium bow with a solid clunk that would have been audible on the other boat, if not for the roar of their own donk. The shadowy mangroves swallowed them up, to the point where I no longer followed them visually but relied on my own plotter to take me through. The chart didn't actually show the lagoon, only a thin black line where I'd gone before, over what appeared as dry land. Knowing, however, that there was no other entrance to the lagoon, I relaxed somewhat. I did my best to recall the geography of the place. Even as I entered the narrow mangrove chalk channel that had taken me in there, the flying fox stink was strong here, and I could hear them squabbling nearby. Gremlin-like cries, shaking branches as they leapt from limb to limb. The channel seemed much longer than it had when I was there with Malia, twisting torturously. Once or twice I veered inadvertently into the trees, feeling mangrove leaves brush my shoulders, overcorrecting, relaxing once I was back on track. Finally, the waterway spread its arms into the lagoon. Out of the far bank I saw a fire burning. Not just a cooking fire, but a good blaze. It must have been designed to provide light over a wide area, rather than keep people warm or cook food. I saw no point in continuing to follow the other boat, and instead made for the western bank, nudging the throttle up a little in an effort to be off the water pretty much as soon as they were. The lagoon was a different place at night than it had been in late morning and noon. Now it was eerie and strange, dark and mysterious. The main hazards were the trees that rose up through the ghostly water. Once or twice the hull nudged against submerged timbers, but an ounce of extra power was enough to free the hull again. As the bank became visible, I pushed on into the lilies and clumps of hydrilla. Keeping the throttle going, I let the prop chew its way through, only cutting the motor a couple of metres from shore when they were too thick to continue. Mindful as ever of the danger of crocs, I spun the hull so that she was beam onto the shore, stepped into knee-deep water, dragging the hull by the bow rope and making it fast to a spindly tree trunk. Taking only a torch with me, I crept along the spongy grass of the bank towards the fire. Even at a distance, the fire illuminated the riverbank so effectively that I saw the Yates punt nudge against the jetty. What surprised me most were the number of faces out there in the night. 20, maybe 30 men around the fire and along the riverbank. Men of the Roper, 1,000 generations old. Black faces and mostly shirtless chests, shining in the firelight, streaked across with scars, bearded faces. Loud voices reflected across the water's surface. Terry Yates dragged a tarpaulin off the load in the tinny, and in concert with Hendo and his own brother Wallaby, began to unload, piling boxes onto the jetty timbers. I quickened the pace, desperate to see what they were unloading. Boxes were the height and width of a concrete building block, and by the way they handled them, both heavy and delicate. Men came from around the firelight to start moving the mysterious cargo up the riverbank and closer to the firelight, though at this stage I found myself having to skirt a side inlet, moving out of sight for 2 or 3 minutes before I reached the shallows or was able to turn and continue my circumnavigation of the lagoon. Soon I found myself close to the action, on the fringes of the last flicker of the firelight, and I had to move stealthily. At a distance of perhaps 50 metres, I stopped behind a burnt-out tree trunk, crouched down and began to observe the scene. The tinny had been so heavily loaded that the stack of cargo was only halfway depleted. Closer now, I saw it for what it was, at once flabbergasted and surprised. I clutched at the tree for balance. Hendo and his bully boys were unloading in the hundreds, the most potent toxin yet introduced to the north of Australia. alcohol in the form of cask wine, 5-liter casks of Coolabah Riesling, the cheapest form of oblivion available. My anger was such that if I possessed a firearm at that moment, I'm not sure that I wouldn't have sent a bullet through Ian Henderson's selfish, greedy head. Instead, I remain where I was, watching his eager hands on the bank open casks, pulling the bladder out so they could be squeezed harder and fill tin mugs quicker. One dark-bearded man held the cask high and sucked the tap into his mouth, squeezing the bag and drinking while the excess spilled out around his lips and over his bare chest. For a quarter of an hour, the unloading went on. The cargo, changing to green cartons of beer, opened as quickly as they were stacked on the jetty. Then, finally, the punt empty, the three white men stepped out onto the bank, their own beer studies in hand, joining the circle around the firelight, laughing and watching the antics of the drinkers. Those bastards were doing the unforgivable. Bringing alcohol into an area that was the only refuge for men, women and children who'd said no to the sickness and sought refuge in this so-called dry place. Still, I couldn't make sense of what had just seen. No money had changed hands. Why would they do it? What did it mean? Even before the headlights appeared in the night, however, the pieces of the puzzle were already assembling in my mind. The vehicle came slowly out of the wilderness, wheels stumbling along on jagged rocks as it came down the ridge beyond the lagoon. It was a diesel, motor idling with a steady rattle. When it came to the firelight, I recognized it as an aged, trayback Land Cruiser, maybe an FJ-55 with the imprint of a hard life and the multicolored panels, scrapes and dings. The tray itself was piled high with sacks, and even as it came to a halt, half-drunk men were swarming aboard. The driver stepped out and greeted first Hendo and then the Yates boys. Leading them to the rear of the Toyota, he opened one of the sacks, reached in and withdrew a half a handful of something from inside. I watched, scarcely breathing as Terry Yates produced a packet of papers and proceeded to roll a cigarette, using a generous pinch of dark green matter from inside the sack. He took two or three deep drags, then passed it on to Wallaby, who did the same, coughed, then offered the remainder to Hendo, who refused. The sweet smell of burning ganja drifted all the way to my hiding place. Hendo's plan was so simple. Come up here for 6 months of the year, set up half a dozen plantations in remote locations, show the locals how to tend the crops and dry out the plants, pay them in grog for their work. Boat the dried dope out to a waiting catamaran. When the boat was full, load up a massive caravan with another $2 or $3 million worth and drive back south. With only one cop in a 400-kilometer radius, it was relatively risk-free and not hard work. My only thought now was how to comprehensively and quickly stop them, how to smash the whole thing and get the grog back out of the community. Bringing these amounts of alcohol in was just not immoral, it was murder. Half a dozen men helped carry the sacks towards the punts, where the Yates boys, giggling like children, were stacking the booty high. The work went quickly, and the sacks were relatively light. Even when they were finished, despite the bulk, the boat didn't ride as low in the water as it had earlier. Around the firelight, the drinkers gathered, shouting and dancing. To my tired mind, they ceased to be men, but became lifeless automatons whose humanity had been taken away, made dependent on an insidious little chemical that had the power to take over a man, mind and body, until he's more slave than master, even over himself. A chemical that's destroying one new generation after another, leaving the next parentless and with few options than to tread the same path. All the horror of Catherine flooded into my mind. The unconscious bodies on the street, a town with a murder rate higher than Redfernus and Kilda, bashings, eye gougings, brother against brother, husband against wife, sick men and women in sick little circles. No one can stop a person who wants to drink above all things. Now, here, the bush that had once been an escape was taking on a hell-like glow. The dance around that firelight was the dance of death. Already a fight had started in the shadows. Men shrieking, living in that moment, in that flush of inebriation where anything seems possible. My eyes must have glazed over, for when I came fully to my senses, Wallaby Yates was pulling the start of the murk over and over again, swearing loudly, the motor sputtering away for a few seconds before dying. Finally, revving the shit out of it so that it rattled like a crazy thing. He jerked it into gear and they're away, leaving the scent of carnage that to me was more like Armageddon than the fringes of a pretty lagoon. The poor bastards around the fire were making so much noise by that stage. I was able to motor slowly across the lagoon, glancing back now and then to see them still writhing by the firelight. Delirious with the false excitement that alcohol hides behind its aromas and textures and aftertaste. I raised the outboard leg and motored through the shallows, deeply depressed, and beneath it all, damn it to hell. A desire not to run away, but to join them, to crawl myself under that blanket of forgetfulness and dullness, to drink until I could no longer think or feel. Back out past the island, I stopped the boat and attempted to get control of myself. This was serious, sickening shit. It couldn't be allowed to continue, not for one day, not even a minute. By the time the sun rose and set once more, I knew people would have died for Ian Henderson's greed. You couldn't unleash such a torrent of free alcohol and expect nothing to happen. When I started the engine again, I had a plan. Get back to Camp Leichhardt and to mobile phone coverage. I needed to make a call. Get Chris out here in a hurry. Not just him, but call New Hudson, the superintendent back in Catherine. The catamaran needed to be intercepted. Vans rowed, men arrested. Back in the main channel, I gunned the Honda. If they were waiting, I didn't really care now. I could probably outrun them if I needed to. One thing drove my actions, the need to get back to camp and make the call. Besides, I was almost certain that they'd turn downstream and be making another run out to sea to meet the catamaran. Oh, Jesus, how dark that night was as I hammered this vessel upstream. A light breeze puffed over the water and the hull thumped a little as she hit the ruffles. My hands, however, shook on the throttle. I found myself unaccountably weeping into the night. As if only I in the dark slipstream cared for what was happening here in this country's heart of darkness, where closed eyes have replaced paternalism. Only the route logged on the sounder, the joined dots allowed me to navigate, hands tight on the tiller, still angry enough to kill. How much money was at stake? Millions, most definitely. For legal purposes, a single dope plant had a calculated street value of $1,000. How many plantations are in operation here? How many plants altogether? Many thousands, perhaps tens of thousands. Incalculable sums of money. Just upstream off the ramp, I motored in. Nudged the bank and tied off. I climbed the bank in darkness again, collecting a coat of mud on my boots and walked downstream to where my Toyota sat in dark silhouette. I unlocked the door and pulled my mobile out of the glove box. No service. I swore softly. The signal had up to then been reliable within 500 metres or so of the camp. I climbed into the driver's seat and turned the key. Not even a click. Suspicion was quickly becoming reality. I popped the bonnet and with the aid of a flashlight from the glove box surveyed a mess of severed wires. Someone had been busy with a pair of side cutters. Closing the bonnet with a metallic thud, I turned towards the camp, aware with that beginner chess player's feeling that the men I was up against were way ahead of me. Mayor Davis' van was in darkness, but I knocked on the door regardless, hearing that hollow caravan rattle as it did so. The voice that came was tired and croaky, yet lacked the anger you might expect of a man being awoken at midnight. Yes? It's Ben Mulligan. I want to have a word with you. What about? Something important? At this time of night? Right now? Give us a minute. There were sounds of feet on the deck of the caravan, but no pause for him to get dressed. Only a man expecting to get woken up sleeps with his clothes on. He pushed the door open, clutched at the jamb for balance, then wobbled his way down the single step and onto the ground. Now, what seems to be the problem? I lifted my phone. No mobile coverage. You dickhead. Davis hissed the words. Why would you wake a man just to tell him that? You got to make a call after midnight? This is important. What's happened to the coverage? He made an exaggerated shrug with hands and shoulders. Who the fuck knows? Who cares? Go to bed, you dumb shit. Davis was an older man, but I was sure by then that he was as guilty as sin. I was angry and tired, and in no mood to be condescended to by someone up to his neck in something as ugly as hell. I grabbed him under the armpits, lifting him a few inches off the ground. "You've got about 10 seconds to tell me what the hell's going on before I take your head off. Got it?" Davis began spluttering. "I don't know what the hell you're on about." "Don't you? Start talking. Drugs? Booze? What's your partner? I've seen it happening. I know. You're going to end up inside for 5 years unless you start helping me right now." "Fuck off." I squeezed him one last time for good measure before dropping him. He scrambled back into the van and locked the door behind him. I turned away into the night. I had no time to waste. Malia must have been asleep because she took a while to get to the door. Her voice was husky and warm like a woman's voice when they can be just woken. Hell, I could even smell the sleepiness of her. I wanted more than anything in the world to crawl into bed and hold her in the night and shut it all out. Her eyes were dark as river pools. "Ben, what happened? Why are you here?" "Can I come in?" "Of course. You're white as a ghost. What's going on?" She poured me a glass of cold water and sat me down at a dinette the size of a pool table while I told her what I'd seen. She sat down next to me. "What are you going to do?" I was going to call in the cavalry, but the mobile phone system just happened to be out. "That's okay. We've got a satellite phone. You can use that." There was something in her eyes that made me pause. "I'm sorry. I know he's your husband and all, but he's doing something awful here, really bad." Seeing her stricken expression, I put my arm around her, feeling the shivering tremor of her body. Her eyes were huge, vulnerable. "What will happen to me if he's arrested?" she asked. I felt a tenderness that was bigger than life or pain. This woman was now my responsibility. "I'll look after you. You know that, don't you?" "Yes, I know." We embraced, but she broke it off quickly, getting a black phone handset off a charging cradle and bringing it to me. I took it off her and got Chris's number off my mobile, knowing that I had to call him first, though. I would have preferred just to go straight to the top instead of dealing with his skepticism after the failed search for the crop. I did the right thing, however, and called, much as I hated waking a family man in the middle of the night. Surprisingly, it answered third ring. "Chris?" "Yeah, it's Ben here. You're up late?" "You're not going to believe what those bastards are doing down here. I just saw the whole thing with my own eyes." The words tumbled out of me. When I was finished, he went soft and it seemed to me resigned. "It all adds up then." "It does." "Yeah. Things have been happening at this end too. So you believe me about the dope crop now?" "Of course I do. Always did. It was just frustrating to go out there and find the place clean." "Let's do this properly," I said. "Get the drug squad down here. Roll the whole thing up." "Absolutely right," he said. "I'll call them now. You help me out, we can get some hard evidence tonight." "How?" "There's another meeting soon. That wasn't the only one. With you as backup, we can wrap up a couple of the conspirators in possession of part of one of the crops. That'd be worthwhile, wouldn't it?" So one shipment was going out by road, I thought to myself, spreading the risk. "It'd certainly help if you could arrest them red-handed. Where do you want to meet?" "Have you got a map?" "Of course." Just before Bullockie Creek Road, there's a track that runs along a fence line down to the left. 3.5 k's down there, there's a cluster of boulders the blackfellas call the turkey eggs. Meet me there in half an hour." "Yeah, providing I can get hold of a vehicle. Where's yours?" "Every ledge you can get at's been severed with side cutters. Nice friends you got down there. See you soon." "Yeah, see ya." When I put down the phone, Malia looked at me with wary eyes, swollen and softened around the edges by tears. "Don't go. Have a Suzuki. Let's drive away from here. There's no need for you to do anything dangerous." As if to illustrate her willingness to pursue the idea, she opened a wardrobe, began pulling out clothes. I couldn't think. I didn't know what to do. The idea was appealing. Before my amazed eye, she turned her back, unbuttoned her pajama top, slipping it down through her arms. Then clipped on a bra and white shirt. Then she did the same thing with the bottom half. Next, a small suitcase appeared. She started throwing clothes inside. "No, Malia. I have to go with Chris," I said finally. "He's my colleague, my mate. He needs me." He needs you? No, he doesn't, but I do. You don't understand my husband. He kills men if they get in his way. He's done it before. You've already been shot at once. I'm a cop. I have to see this through. You're on holidays. I had to laugh then. Just a chuckle. That line again. Come with me, Ben, right now. This minute. Her body language combined with her eyes to plead with me. Hands folded together below her chin. Head bowed. I'm falling in love with you, and I don't want to lose you. It's hard to describe how I felt to hear those words, and at first I struggled for a response. I feel the same way, but I can't go just yet. I stopped, knowing how crass the next question was going to be. Can I borrow your car? Malia stopped packing, walked to the kitchen bench and threw the keys at me, straight and hard. You stupid bastard, just go and get yourself killed. If there was ever a moment when I might have changed my mind, that was it. And later, of course, I wished to God I had. Instead, a sense of duty, not to my job, but to natural justice, sent me out into the night and away. The tachometer needle on the Suzuki had probably never seen quite so much of the red line as it did that night. There was no traffic. Just one road train careering down the middle of the road as if on rails, spotlights turning night into day, forcing me over onto the verge. Poor bastards must hate all the driving, the endless roads, bringing store cattle up from one of the Gulf stations, Nathan River maybe. So busy was my mind that I almost missed the turn. It was the fence line that did it for me, jogging my memory. The track was narrow and corrugated, with the occasional washout deep and trench-like that required slowing right down and full attention. I noticed tire tracks for at least one vehicle had travelled along in the last few hours or so. Finally, the headlights picked up the rounded rocks that must have been the turkey eggs. There was no one around. I killed the engine and wound down the window, listening to the slow ticking as the engine cooled and the night sounds out in the bush. While I waited, I thought about Malia. Of course I'd wanted to go with her. I was captivated. I'd never encountered a particular mix of femininity, physical competence, and intelligence before. I wanted her, badly, more than anything. But the demons in my mind were all bound up with the demons of this place. I had to lay them to rest first. The sound of tires on the track came before the engine noise. The headlights, yellow light, and LED spotties, blue light, lit the area like day. So bright I couldn't look into them, yet barred with moving shadows from the tree trunks. I stepped out of the car, blinded like a night animal confronted with dawn, still holding the door for balance. The other vehicle stopped, engine running. I waited as the spotlight switched off and I saw the vehicle outline for the first time. A door slammed. First Hendo. Then the Yates boys got out, one after the other, seemingly taller than I remembered, wraith-like in silhouette. My grip on the door tightened. "Where's Chris?" I called. "Oh, sorry," said Hendo. "He couldn't make it." "What a shame, you poor fucker. You got me instead, and I have to warn you, I'm angry. You've turned into a pain in the ass." "If you've hurt Chris, you're in a pile of shit." Hendo laughed, and I wondered why. "I've been making inquiries about you," he smirked. "Thought you were such a holier-than-thou princess, with your not drinking all that shit. I found out why, and it's not pretty, is it?" I can take a punch as well as the next bloke, but this king hit sent me reeling. How the hell did he find out? Who'd he been talking to? "Nice girl too," he said. "Dead? Just 19, wasn't she? Tell us, Mulligan. Tell us why you don't drink." This was something I couldn't handle, couldn't think about. "Oh, Jesus. She okay? Tell me she's okay, please." I remember the paramedic's voice when I screamed it out to him, squinting at the wreckage and flotsam of the crash strewn all over the road verge. Voice, deadpan. "Your girlfriend's dead, mate." "Pissed." "Yeah. Been shotgunning cans in good old territory style down near the riverbank. Middle of the day, drunk, with the sunlit world like streaks of liquid dye down the insides of my eyelids. Crying on the side of the road with blood running down my neck from a cut on my chin. flooding down my shirt, more cars stopping and people staring. Then at the hospital, male nurse wanting to stick a needle in my arm for the blood alcohol sample. I remember then how the station sergeant Grant Lewis, who never seemed to like me anyway, rolled up his sleeve and said to the nurse, "Here, son, take the blood from here, okay?" The kid looked like he'd swallowed a lemon. "I really can't. Just do it, you little prick," Lewis had said. And I watched the nurse take the blood from his arm. He stared at me like I was undergoing some baptism of fire. His eyes said, "It's okay. We always look after our own around here." Then, of course, the blood alcohol reading had come back under the limit. I was safe. And Sergeant Grant Lewis had draped an arm around my back the next day like he was my brother. And I was off scot-free, but a beautiful girl was lying dead in the morgue. I had to face a family. Telling them I was sorry was woefully insufficient. Yet what else could I give them? I had 2 weeks leave in Darwin, wandering from the Vic Hotel to Limbs to the casino, carousing with cops I'd known through training who'd all heard what had happened and didn't want to talk about it either. "No wonder you don't drink," Hendo said. "You killed a girl. Drunk. You fucking idiot. That's why you don't drink." I stared at him, wanting to explain. The accident didn't stop me drinking. It started it, really. Drinking to forget the thing that drinking made me do. That was when I really learned what grog can do to a man. How it deadens the heart and soul from pain, but after a while, pleasure as well. Wallaby Yates was getting something from the boot of the car. I stared at the thing in his hands, the polished wooden blued steel of a hunting rifle. I was so dazed I didn't even connect the damn thing with my own safety. Just looked stupidly at the gun, wondered what the hell they were going to do with it. I turned my face towards Hendo and I saw something in his eyes. Something that meant death to me. He was going to kill me. The bastard was going to kill me. Death wasn't a strange concept. I'd stared that spectre down on more than one occasion. I considered all the options, all the ways and means and how it might feel. Even stood in the shed near the rack of fishing rods with my hands on a coil of blue and yellow telecom rope and stared up at the timber beams in a chair and thought how easy it would be. I'd held the Turkish walnut stock of a Brno Model 2 in my hands and touched the muzzle to my lips so I could taste the bitter salt of the gun oil. Listened to all the different corners of my heart state their case. Fear. Desire for escape, knowing that somehow my punishment was not yet done. The problem was that sober, I just couldn't escape the memories. The witness of the hospital and the crowds as the ambos brought us in, doctors, nurses, and even then I didn't realise that they were giving up trying to save a life. "Your girlfriend's dead, mate." Oh, fuck. Even now how those words scream through my soul and I see her the way I last saw her. And I see the expressions of their faces, how I'd taken her life in my hands, let her into my car, when I shouldn't have been in charge of a chair, let alone a motor vehicle. Beneath it all, before and after, is the fog of alcohol, the thickness, the forgetting, the nights when I drank until I couldn't stop crying. Mates sitting with me on the steps below the elevated upper floor of that house we shared while I let the grog take the twist top off my grief. The creamy, evil-smelling stuff inside drained out. This wasn't the way it was supposed to be. This was supposed to be the beginning, not the end for us. This wasn't life. And most of the time, I wished I was dead beside her on that road. 6 months passed in an alcoholic blur, lying drunk in the darkness, listening to music, listening to the special songs over and over again. The ones that you think are going to explain it all. Only problem is that nothing can. Music goes closest, gets you leaning out close to touch it, but still your hands are empty. When you're drunk, you go closer still, close enough that your hands are out straight, quivering. Your fingertips brush against it. In a blink, of course, it's gone. You're left there, nothing more than a receptacle. No epiphany. Just an awareness of your own mortality brought closer by the toxic soup in your blood. Confused synapses bringing on a pleasure and pain that leaves imprints on the soul. I wished I'd had a god to turn to. I just don't have religion in me. Haven't since at the age of 11. I spent a couple of months examining it from every angle. I decided I couldn't believe in a maker, a designer who sits plotting and planning, moving human hearts on a chessboard, sitting on a throne of gold. I couldn't believe in a heaven or hell, only life and death. And I pointed at me. Just shoot the bastard, he said. All of the eights looked across at him. You sure? He's a cop. Don't know, I want a murder rap hanging over my head. What else are you supposed to do with him, Terry said. He's been sneaking around, watching us for days. All we have to do is chuck his body in the boat, run him downstream from the ramp a few miles, push him overboard. Crocs will chew him up. It'll look like an accident. No one will ever know. All of the eights appeared to internalize this reasoning fairly rapidly. The gun came up and he walked towards me. I could hardly believe what was happening and I remained there, dumbly, hanging onto the car door. This halfwit was going to kill me. He really thought he could get away with it. I literally couldn't move a muscle. No one could. Couldn't even blink as he drew back the bolt and I heard the cartridge slide into the chamber.